Niger, in West Africa, and the relation with the topic, obviously apart from breeding itself, is also that we seem to have put a lot of accent, a big accent in the previous presentations, at least the ones I've been listening to, on the importance of animal-environment interaction, and particularly on the importance of it when you cannot change the environment. Now, usually the approach, as far as I understand it as a non-specialist, the approach to animal production is to externalize the environment from the production system as much as we can, no? Control it or limiting it to the point that it doesn't really matter anymore. But what happens when you cannot do it? What happens when the environment is so overwhelming in the situation in which you are working that you cannot really ignore it? And at that point, having animals who do not interact with the environment may not be the best solution. Instead, you might want animals who can interact with the environment, and perhaps from the interaction with the environment, you can get an extra to increase production rather than just problems. So this is what I think the Wudabe do. Okay. The presentation will focus on brief introduction to what the Wudabe are, who is the name of these guys, how do they breed their cattle, and finally, if there is time, I will make some reference to methodological implications. Yes. Can I carry on? The fundamental thesis I will discuss, in a way, can be summarized in this way. No? The Wudabe can exploit environmental variability for animal production. So this is a bit unusual, because environmental variability has always been considered a problem, and the only way to tackle it has been to increase control. A few clarifications, as we have to be careful how we use terms. In this case, the Wudabe is, I just explained briefly what they are. They are full-time herders. They are cattle keepers. They keep some small stock, but they are mainly cattle keepers. And they keep a very large breed of cattle for the area they work. So large that the French veterinarians in the 30s, when they first saw them, thought that they were just impossible to keep, and immediately recommended to keep smaller animals instead. And they produce for the beef market. So forget subsistence economy. Yeah, they drink the milk, but they buy everything else from the market, including their sandals, their clothes, and in some cases, even their sticks. And they operate with a very low external input conditions in one of the harshest environments on Earth, and usually very far away from services of any kind, and with a relatively weak political control on the territory. And what do I mean with environmental variability? In a bit more technical way, I mean the unpredictably patchy and short-lived concentrations of nutrients. Rainfall is very patchy. You cannot know where it's going to fall, and you cannot know for what extent of territory. So you can have a drought here and a perfectly good year 1 kilometer or 2 kilometers away from this area. And it's a different world, and it's very close to, no, they're very close to one another. So what happens is that with the rainy season, even when they get a rainy season, and I will enter a little bit more into details further on, with the rainy season, instead of raining everywhere at the same time, it rains in a certain area, and then it might stop. It might never rain again there for the rest of the rainy season. It might carry on a little bit more, and maybe rains a little bit more in a different area. And the fundamental difference with the situation in which it rains uniformly everywhere is that rains trigger the development of grass at different stages. So instead of having all grass in your territory developing at the same time, and then you have to eat it, if you want to eat it at the best time of a nutritional content, you know, at the best stage of the vital cycle, then you have to eat it all at the same time, and you can't, of course. But in this way, the grass is triggered at different times, and you can, with mobility, you can have a situation in which you are keeping the animals on the grass at the stage of development that might last for a couple of weeks, and you can do that for 3 months, because you just move them as the grass is started in different places. No? You have to do it timely. It's not an easy business, and you will see why. And finally, what do I mean for animal production? Well, not quite what is meant in animal science in the West. I mean more what you can describe as a flow of production that can reliably keep within acceptable bandwidths over the long term. So time is crucial. They don't try to achieve maximum production. They try to keep productivity over the long term. Because if they don't have that, they are destituted. Because sooner or later they will have a very big problem. They will have a drought or something like that. It's always happened. It's not in news of the last 20 or 30 years. And when they have a situation like that, maybe 2 years, I'm not talking of a hot, dry season. I'm talking of at least 2, perhaps 3 years without water or with hardly any water. So, in fact, without grass or with hardly any grass. Water doesn't really matter. What matters is grass, is what the animals can eat. Now, water's in the wells, roughly, you can always find. But if there is nothing to eat, it doesn't really matter because you cannot keep the animals there. So, where are they? This is Niger. You can see the black spot up there, West Africa. Top left is Algeria, then Libya. To the west is Mali. South is Nigeria. You can see. The ones I worked with are in Niger, but obviously, being a nomadic population, you find them more or less from Senegal to Sudan. So all along the Sahel. In Niger, there is a strong number of them. They arrived in Niger at the beginning of the 19th century, quite opportunistically, after the Rinderpest had killed most of their animals in Nigeria, and many of them had been farming, trying to rebuild their herds, some for 50, some for 60 years. And at some point, the fast urbanization in Nigeria raised the price of livestock so much that even with herds that were not just as numerous, as large as the ones they had before the Rinderpest, they could take the bush and go back to a specialized form of production. And I want to be very, I want to emphasize the fact that specialized form of production in this case means a very different form of production from the one that you can have with a smaller number of animals. There is a threshold below which you cannot apply a specialized form of production as the one that I'm going to describe. So they're forced to do something completely different. But as soon as they have enough animals to stay in the bush and move, then they can. And at that point, the price was so high that even with a relatively small herd, 30, 40 animals, of course, it depends on what sort of animals and what proportion of reproductive animals within the herd, but they could sell not very much, but with high price, they could sell enough to survive. Just some figures to describe the situation. I have deliberately put between 0 and 400, and I have deliberately put between 10 and 52 degrees, because what really matters is that there is a very high non-uniformity. The excursion is huge. And you can have 0, you can have 400. And whether on average you have 250 or 200 is completely irrelevant, because averages never happen. And the same with temperature. 10 degrees is probably a night during the cold, dry season, so December, January. Might probably go below that, not so much with the thermometer, but for the body, because it can be very windy, and if you are sleeping outside, as they do, probably with no blanket or with a poor blanket, you freeze even with 10 degrees or even with 14. And during the day, it goes up to, in the hot dry season, it goes up to 52 in the shade. A very difficult condition, as you can imagine, for animals to eat and ruminate. Also considering that in order to eat, they had to stay under the sun, obviously, and not in the shade. Animals eat up to 60 different plants. Each one of them has obviously very sophisticated defense systems. And at the peak of the dry season, they can be watered every second day. So they will eat for a couple of days, and then the herder will take them to the well, which might be by the end of the dry season, by the peak of the dry season, that is May, June, might be up to 30 kilometers away from where the camp is and where the animals eat. So it will take them 6, 7 hours, 8 hours walk to go there. They will rest a little bit, but not too much, because watering is very tiring and you don't really want to do it under the sun. So they will rest a bit, and then they will try to do as much watering as possible before the sun is too hot. And I can tell you, at the peak of the dry season, the sun for me was too hot about 20 minutes after it came out. So that's the situation. 47 degrees, 9 o'clock in the morning, that kind of thing. So it comes out at 7, half past 7, you are looking for the shade. Myself, they obviously can stay a bit longer, but they don't want to be out at 11. Few words about the conditions of nutritional impact. What does that mean? The environment is incredibly diverse, and diversity can be described in terms of space, time, and also in terms of what I called, in lack of better description, use complexity. What do I mean? There is diversity of ecozones due to the fact that rainfall is patchy, so somewhere there is grass and somewhere there isn't. Then, of course, there is diversity of soil composition, sandy soil, clay soil, trigger the growth at different times. Diversity of plant species, certain plants grow faster, grow sooner, or might have more nutrients than others. And also diversity within individual plants within the same species. Not all individual plants contain the same amount of nutrients. And if the animals have the capacity to select and eat the ones with more nutrients and leave the ones with less nutrients, that could be an advantage. And finally, of course, there is diversity in time. I've talked about stage of development, and there is also diversity from morning to evening. The plant accumulates nutrients during the day, so if you eat it in the evening, the same plant will give you more than if you eat it in the morning. And finally, there is complexity in use. Animals can eat not just one plant, but combinations of plants, and sometimes just one plant doesn't really stimulate the appetite, particularly during the dry season when it isn't very good, and it's obviously it's dry and not particularly interesting. But if eaten together with certain tree leaves or bushes, then they might get the extra mineral or whatever extra stimulus they get from the other plant, and that will stimulate them to eat a bit more of the uninteresting grass, which gives the bulk of the nutrients. So we'll stimulate to feed more. And finally, levels of stress, which can be triggered by environmental conditions. Could be a lot of thorns on the plants, could be ticks, could be dungs on the ground, so bad smell, presence of other animals, competition, antagonistic behavior from other animals in the herd, you name it. No? And all these elements, if taken care of by the management system, might improve the production of the animals. I have a little video that I want to show you, which I hope will work. It's a bit dark, but maybe if you close your eyes for a few seconds and we switch the light off, we might even manage to see something. Can I? Yeah? And also I need to do the... Can you see anything? Yeah. Forgive the long text at the beginning. It wasn't really designed for this use, but then it gets more interesting. Okay, this should just give you an idea, no, of what kind of environment. I want to give you a couple of set of informations on how they keep these animals. First of all, they have a rather sophisticated system for naming them, and each animal receives the name of the mother. So each animal, whether it is a male or a female, will have the same name. I've become an expert of technology in this room. That means that out of a herd, maybe of 40 or 50 animals, they might have four names or five names. And each name corresponds to a line, no? To a lineage. So they will keep track of their animals by lineage. Now, the fact that they organize the herd in this way has consequences in the way they see them, they see the animals, when time comes for selling, for looking after them, for deciding not to sell, for mating, and for choosing what bull to use for a certain cow. So this is a situation in which the mental organization of the herd by the herder actually has effects on the way the herder interacts and makes decisions with regard to breeding, interacts with the animals and makes decisions with regard to breeding. They could be organized by patrilinear lineages, but they are organized by matrilinear lineages. This doesn't mean that they don't know the name of the fathers, they do, or they don't keep memories of the genealogies of bulls, they do. But if they talk about the herd, they will talk in terms of matrilinear genealogies, which is what I followed during my research. The reason why I work with them is that they are particularly famous for keeping memory of genealogies of their herd. To a significant extent of precision. Obviously, some better than others. Huh? It's not an exact science. But if you find the right person, this person will be able to give you rather detailed information, animal by animal, born in the herd up to maybe 20 years' death. And the limit of 20 years is more than a mnemonic limit, is because 20, 30 years ago, they had a very big drought, 1984, 85, and so going behind that is complicated, is painful, and so on. No? But up to around 84, you can have information animal by animal. And using, as I did, a chronology line, so obviously you have to identify some starting point in relation to maybe some historical event, the date of which you know, they might not, but you do. And then you just carry on adding time to that. So you have a fairly detailed chronology line. And at that point, you can have a grid of animals and dates with an approximation of maybe 4 months, 5 months, but roughly, okay? So with that sort of grid, you are able to find out whether they are telling the truth or they are remembering well, rather than not. Because they will say, okay, I used the bull so-and-so for mating with the cow so-and-so in 1983, and if they told you the day before that I had sold it in 1985, you can say, ah, I'm gone. Yesterday you told me that. No? So what happened? So that died maybe the year before. No? And these situations happened. You discuss it with them. They last the brother, the cousin, the sister, or whoever, and somehow you get to a solution, or you get to a point in which they say, ooh, I really don't remember about this one. Sorry. But it doesn't happen very often. Before I talk about selective mating, I want to say that herd reproduction is very peculiar. They are giving one, two, three, four, now it tends to go down because of poverty, but a certain number of animals at every child, every newborn child, male and female. Males do get more, but and particularly now that there aren't very many animals. But in normal conditions, there isn't a big difference. Who is giving? The father, the brother of the father, the uncles. They're always heifers, of course. Always females. And these will be the matriarchs of the herd of the newborn child, if a male. And if it's a girl, she will keep these animals in the herd of the brother or the husband or what. No, actually not the husband. The brother or the father. So the animals stay with the family of the father, although they are their animals, you know, her animals. In this way, you have one herd which is growing inside another herd. It's almost parthenogenesis comes to mind, although of course it's a, it doesn't apply technically. No? But they don't buy the animals from the outside, they create a new herd from within a herd that is already existing and working, which is the fundamental point. No? So the new herd grows by living together with the other ones. It is kept on a slightly different economic regime, in the sense that the father does not sell, or tries his best not to sell any animals from the herd of that are designed to become herds of the children, if not in, in extreme cases. And therefore there is a higher reproduction rate within this sub-herd, which is only visible, obviously, to those who know. Otherwise, you know, the animals are just like any other ones. They're kept together. And finally, with regard to the... I'll come back on this and we'll see why this is important. And finally, with regard to the selective feeding business, by analysing the genealogy of the herd, I was able to see with very, very robust evidence that they... Try to choose the bull in potentially, ideally, in every mating event. So out of 100 birds, in principle, they would have chosen the bull 100 times. It doesn't quite happen like that. There is a certain margin of mistake, 3, 4, 6%, 10% if you include all, people don't remember it very well or so on. No? So anyway, it's extremely high. Maybe 95%, 93% of a herd, the father has been chosen. They have a very short period in which the cow is fertile. They know how to recognize when heat is coming, and they just keep them at the camp, or they keep them separate from a bull if they are sure that that's not the right bull. Okay? And the bull chosen is a very interesting business. Because for a certain period of the life of the herd, now having herds born into another herd means that the herd itself has a somehow a life of its own. Now it starts when the child is born, and somehow it disappears as the father, whose children have already left with their own animals, and has fewer and fewer animals, and then the ones left when the father dies will be divided amongst the children, and the herd will somehow end with the end of the life of the herder. However, the lineages will carry on. Okay, will carry on in different herds if they have resisted, if they are still there. I was saying for the first years they will not have a bull. They don't need a bull. They just use whatever is available according to the choice of the father, not whatever is available. They use what is available in the clan with criteria for choosing, of course. And at some point, if they think they have enough animals and the herd is big enough to justify to have a bull, they'll make their own bull. And that will be the favored bull. And you would expect them to use it at every mating event. No, they don't. In fact, they use it very little, incredibly little, considering. No? They might have another bull or two in the herd, younger, which they may or may not use. Sometimes they use it, maybe once or twice. And otherwise, they will still borrow bulls from friends, and mainly from cousins, but there are many cousins or friends. The reason for this is that breeding is a social enterprise in this case. You could consider them, you know, the individual household, as working within a society of breeders, an association of breeders, which is largely the clan. Immediately, the section of the clan that is made out of cousins, above all, so the sons and, you know, the uncles. And the sons of the uncles, the uncles have died, and the bulls circulate within this area. No? They only use it for one event, so they don't lend the bull. They lend it, but for a day, and after the mount, the bull goes back. No? What they do instead, they circulate heifers. There is a very institutionalized form of loan. It's called habanai. Habanai means, nai is cow, habanai means the attached cow, attached to another herd. So it would be a heifer, maybe a one-year-old, two-year-old, given to my cousin, for example. And my cousin keeps it until the cow, having grown up, the cow produces two calves. Keeps the calves, gives me back the cow. Maybe 4, 3, maybe 10 years later, because calving interval can be quite long in certain cases. So if the first calf is seven, happens when the cow is seven, which is perfectly possible, it's not average, but it is possible, then before she had two, she's been away almost for 10 years. And for politeness, the cousin really should give me back the cow pregnant. Okay? So you have a double situation in which you lend genetic material on a young animal, and then you get back genetic material and, no? And the experience of the animal that has been for 5 years in the herd of the cousin, maybe in a different production strategy, slightly different, still with the habit, but slightly different. Every family has its own habits and different conditions, maybe a different environment. This situation was taught as a form of support for poor families, but although it can be that too, but there are reasons to believe that that's not quite enough to explain it, because a heifer will take anything between 2 and 5 years to produce some milk. So if you get it because you're poor, you get an increasing labor, and that's about it for the next 5 years, by which you could be dead many times. And also, abenaki loans happen in a reciprocal situation often. So I give it to my cousin, and maybe 6 months later or a year later, my cousin gives it to me. And at that point, too fast, sorry. Louder. Yeah, louder, okay. Anyway, production strategy. The main objective, the main focus of their strategy is to increase as much as possible production, and they do that by trying to make sure that the animals eat as well as possible. It is a very common situation to visit a herd maybe 3, 4 weeks after a previous visit, and he's moved camp 5 kilometers away from where he was before, usually even further away from the well. And you travel those 5 kilometers, and you don't see any difference. No? It's not maybe fantastic grass, but it looks more or less the same to me. I get there, and I say, look, why did you move? And he said, oh, grass here is much better, much better. Said, what do you mean, much better? Oh, look! another example is, I won't enter into the details of this, but in Karamoja, in northern Uganda, in the last 10 years, they had a terrible disarmament exercise. They had the army basically occupying pastoral area and telling the herders when to move, how to move, and where to move. And one of the most common accidents is that the commander will tell the herder to stay, and the herder will say, we can't stay, there is no grass. And the commander will look at the pastor and will say, you're a liar, plenty of grass. And that is a very nice example, because obviously they don't mean the same thing. One sees grass, the other one doesn't. So the concern of the herders is to make sure both that the pasture, the diet, the good diet is accessible, and also that is exploitable. The two things don't necessarily go together. No? You can take the animals on the best possible patch, but the animal may not know what to do with it or how to exploit it at the maximum possible level, or may not be able to because of other disturbances that you haven't been able to eliminate for it to use the skills that have been developed through breeding and selection. Okay, what they do, in my view, is they breed towards what is the objective of their production strategy, which is to exploit what I call, with reference to pasture, asymmetric distribution. Is not my definition, but it is my application to pasture, meaning that they are exploiting these concentrations as opposed to looking for uniformity and stability, either by avoiding non-uniformity or by controlling it, if they could, but they can't. Now, a little bit of etiology of feeding selectivity. There has been very interesting research on the feeding selectivity of on the feeding behavior of ruminants, finding that they are very selective, or they can be very selective. And what I picked up from the literature that seemed to be particularly relevant to my study was that this research emphasizes the importance of cognition and emphasizes the importance of stress, which of course is, as we heard, closely related. No? Stress can inhibit the immune system and can inhibit learning, as well as doing other things. And there is a third thing that I need to say, and is that we know also that poor quality diet kills the appetite in ruminants. This is not quite taking into consideration as much as it should, because that means that if the animals cannot compensate, as they can't, with quantity for the lack of quality, they lose weight very quickly if the diet is not good enough. Okay? So their capacity to eat the best bits on the pasture has to be accompanied by their capacity not to eat the rest. Now, to eat everything is not good. You have to be able to only eat this what might be small, little, but best, and only feed your stomach with that. Otherwise, you will lose weight. And these are conditions in which a bit of loss of weight will be incredibly difficult to compensate if it's lost at the wrong time. No? But they're losing weight, obviously, anyway, for almost 9 months in a year. So they must be able to put on weight very, very quickly in that little window that they have available, and they have to be able to not lose too much during the rest. So the dry season starts around September, October, up to December, maybe even January. So eating dry grass, because with the first sun after the end of the rainy season in September, all the grass dries, like being put in the freezer. So eating dry grass, these are animals who can put on weight until the end of December, maybe even January, just on dry grass. And then, of course, they lose until June or May, whenever the new grass comes out. And as soon as the first rains fall, the herder will check, depending on where he is. Jima, in this case, waited. Now, we had rains, but it was not very good rain. That one lasted for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. He didn't even make ponds. And so he didn't really move. And also because he had a lot of grass. You know, you've seen I called it prime pasture. For being the end of the dry season, it was excellent. It was incredibly good year. We had milk every day. We couldn't finish it. That was the end of the dry season. But in a less good year, they would try to rush to the first rains as soon as they know that there is enough grass. No? And as soon as they know that the rain is in the right place, which should really be possibly a sandy area because it grows faster. And at that point, the animals will stop eating dry grass, even if the wet grass is not available yet. Because as soon as they try a put. And it will be very important for them to be able to eat the new grass as soon as possible. So there is a song which has been recorded by an anthropologist who studied these people in the 80s, which says, a man talking about talking with pride about his wonderful breed of bulls and so on, and he says, you know, no bull as nice as my bull is wonderful, blah, 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 and he's got the mouth like the mouth of a little girl. And you think, well, that's a strange idea to, something to talk about bull. And indeed, the point is that a small mouth will allow the animals to eat a very short grass without ingesting very much sand. So actually gives maybe 3-4 days of advantage on a big mouth at the beginning of the rainy season, which is quite important. Not only, but for the same reason, these cows have learned to eat just by pinching with like a goat would do, instead of using the tongue. So they have two different ways of eating, and one way is used for this very short grass, which has a very particular name, has its own name in Fulfulde, the language of the Wudabe, so they recognize it. And behavior. The Wudabe are incredibly good observers of behavior, and they don't only observe their animals' behavior, but they have changed their own behavior over time in what could be, if looked with the right eyes, knowing what to look for, could be very visible. They are very gentle. They have very gentle movements. They speak very softly, particularly when they speak to their cows. They try their best not to hit them. They use a stick, but they wave the stick. If they have to hit them, they try to just touch them on the horns, which is what another cow would do, bang. And that is enough to be disturbed like that, they know. These are very large animals, and as you have seen, the herder doesn't herd them from the back, from the rear, but just walks. And everybody follows. Which is what a cow would do in a normal condition without humans. There would be a leader, and then the group would move. They are never put in a kraal. There is no enclosure. They know no enclosure all their life. And yet they stay around the camp. And the camp is anywhere, you've seen. So they might stay 2 days without water when they don't even try to go to the well. And this feature is known and appreciated and even has a name. It's called geti. Geti is a way to define a lineage, or an animal that usually comes in lineages, a lineage that is particularly attached to the family, to the household. For example, that would never go away without the herder, would never leave the calf at the camp and just go to the well, as other breeds are known to do in the same area, and would come back if stolen. Would try the first opportunity to run and would meet the herder at a certain place that is habitual to the animals. And the herder will know roughly where to look for them. There are also different ways of describing behavior. So there are a lot of names in Fulfulde to describe animal behaviors. They spot curiosity, they spot investigation, they spot those who lie walking at the front of the herd as the herd moves, and those who lie walking at the end. And those who lie walking at the end will only walk at the end when the herd goes away, and will walk at the front when the herd comes back, of course. Because they want to be as near as possible to the camp. And these tend to be gaiting animals. To be the first one in the evening to say, okay, now it's time to go now. The fact that they are so well behaved means that they're famous for being very obedient to very specific signals or command. I haven't seen much of it, I must admit, is in the literature. The only occasion in which I've seen something was when I was talking to the herder, and it was time for him to go, and he wanted to finish his tea and talk to me, and he turns. I haven't got what he's done to the herd, but all of a sudden, all the animals run by themselves towards the pasture. And then calmly he went after when he's finished his tea. And I know that they do things like having all the animals down, no sound if there is a danger of some kind, all the animals waiting by a tree, maybe 2 days, 3 days, if that's the case. And they just stay there until the herder comes back. But anyway, these are excesses, no? It is important to note that they are very careful observers. And they only speak with a certain tone. There is a cow tone, and they're very, very calm, and you say, and they call the animal like that. No? These are not docile animals. If you check for Bororo cows in every possible breed characterization source, starting from DAD or the FAO online, you will find them described as extremely aggressive, impossible to use for work. Some veterinarians in Niger describe them as killer cows. Okay, and they are very aggressive to the people they don't know. So they are selectively docile. They're very discerning. And discerning, the capacity to discern people, food, plants, whatever, and between each other, is a feature that is recognized by the herder as a very important thing to keep in the herd. Okay? And they, when they want to make a distinction between their breed and, say, the Azawak breed, which is another zebu cattle kept by the Tuareg, who live in the same natural environment as them but have a different production system, they will say that the Azawak will go with anybody. And, will eat anything. But theirs only stay in the right place and eat the right things. I jumped the example, maybe. No, I don't. I said the Tuareg have a different production strategy. They focus on water instead of grass. They're not as specialized as the Wahdabe. Although they use the same environment, they use it in a very different way. So if you want, the environment is the same, the natural environment is the same, but the animal's experience of the environment is very different. So as far as the animals are concerned, the environment is different. They experience different things. One group of animals will stay on what, as far as they are concerned, is pasture that is not very good and they don't have very much time to eat it, and the other one will stay on pasture that is excellent and they have plenty of time to eat it because they are camping on it, whereas the other ones are camping near the water. So they have to walk to the pasture, which becomes farther and farther every day because they eat it, and then they have to walk back in the evening if they don't want to be stranded alone in the bush, which of course they don't. And as the herders go nearer the water point, because the dry season becomes hotter and they need more water for the household, the animals have to walk even longer distance. Okay, so they arrive, eat as much as they can, whatever they find, and rush back. And they will have probably walked 2 hours or 3 hours each way. Whereas the Wahdabe, they keep their animals on the grass. They don't need to do more than 500 meters to arrive where they want to eat. When there is not enough at that distance, they move the camp. No problem. Okay, but that means that they are maybe 30 kilometers away from the water, with all the consequences that you can imagine. Water has to be fetched, not only for humans, but for small stock and for the calves. So they have teams of young women, usually, on donkeys, different teams, one every other day, and back and forward. And the water finishes well before the team with the new water comes home. And you just stay there, 50 degrees in the shade, no water, not a drop of water in the camp for 5 hours, 6 hours, hoping that they come back. That's the reality, you know? A good example that shows how the capacity to feed selectively is associated with cognition is of another group of Fulani. They are not Wahdabe, they are not as specialized as the Wahdabe, they are sort of agro-pastoralists, and they live at the border with Nigeria. At the beginning of the rainy season, they will send the people who look after the animals amongst them will be sent to the northern pasture as soon as they know that there is grass in the north. The grass in the north, in the Sahel, the grass in the northern belt is much better than the grass in the south, even if it precisely because it receives less rain. So the rain is never enough for the grass to exhaust the nutrients. So when it comes out, it's excellent. And they send it at the beginning, they send the herd at the beginning of the rainy season, and they come back, some of them come back in October when there is harvest of millet, and some of them come back in January. And I asked why, and they gave me three reasons. Two had to do with labor requirements, it doesn't matter here. And the third one was the animals of those who come back in October are not accustomed to eat on the pasture as the dry season kicks in. Meaning that they lose weight, so they have to come back. However, the animals of the others are accustomed, i.e. know what to do in my reading of it, and they put on weight on the same pasture. This is the same breed, bred from the same village, maybe my cousin, on the same rangeland, in the same season. Some put on weight, some lose it. Amongst the observation, there are observations that have to do with indicators of health. These are usually the most evident, the quality of milk, organoleptic qualities of milk, and the texture and color of the feces. So the animals, every time the animals come back in the evening, the senior herder doesn't normally take them out. Maybe he's a son, a younger son, depending on how old is the son, or are the sons. But anyway, in case the herder doesn't go out with the animals, he can still check where the animals have been taken and what they have eaten by looking at the feces and by drinking the milk. They claim they can distinguish milk from different lineages. Why not? We can distinguish the year of a wine, so in principle. I don't have reason to think that they are lying, but I didn't verify it empirically, though. But they can certainly distinguish different properties of the milk and associate them to feeding on particular plants. Can be more frothy, can be thin, can be thick, can be sour, can be sweet, fattier, whatever. So they will know from drinking the milk in the evening how is the animal. And they associate the organoleptic properties of milk to lineages. So they will say that their favorite lineage is also the one that has the best milk. And of course, the one who has the best milk is also the one who is more selective in feeding. So, as it turns out, their favorite lineage is the one that is more selective in feeding. Okay? And that will be the one that they try not to sell. However, it's not the best lineage. As with bulls, they don't select a best lineage. They have a favorite lineage, which is a very different thing. But they will look after all the others. And when I asked them, why don't you use, for example, the best bull to mate with all the animals when they need to, they said, oh, you don't want to have them all looking the same, even if it's the best bull. So diversity is crucially built, intentionally built into the herd. And the explanation seems to me very, very easy and very obvious. If you have to face unpredictable conditions, you want to have as much variability, harnessed variability, not just chaotic variability, but you want to have as much structured variability as possible, because you never know where it's going to come. Some animals might be good now and not good in a year or two. Some animals are best in case of drought, and others are best in case of good years, and you need to be able to balance. They pay a lot of attention to cognition, and they know what helps the animals to learn to a certain extent. I haven't verified whether this is intentional or not, but amongst the practices, one is to give salt, of course, at the beginning of the rainy season, end of the dry season, they give salt. And one of the ways of giving salt is to mix them, to mix the salt with some dry leaves of certain plants. And that could be perfectly a way of habituating an animal to a different plant, because the salt will make them eat the plant, and they will know at that point the taste of this other plant. But I have not verified that that's exactly the reason why they do it. They might not know it themselves, but they favor learning experiences. And amongst the other things that they favor the conditions, the non-stressful conditions that would favor learning experiences. And this could be described with a reference to using species-specific management signals. I talk about this in the next one. No, actually, I can just move to that. What are species-specific management signals? For example, they usually keep a herd of a size of about 50, 60 individuals, 60 head, which is roughly what has been observed to be the number of a herd of cows in feral conditions. Those people who studied that think that this rough limit has to do with the animal's capacity to remember hierarchical positions, relative positions. So when the number grows significantly above this threshold, they don't remember as efficiently anymore, and the episodes of antagonism increase, not conflict increase. Otherwise, if everybody knows his place, everything is specific and goes on very fine. So they certainly try with this system and other systems like that to minimize episodes of antagonism within the herd and to have a social organization of the herd that is as robust and good as possible. And they know that that will help animals to eat better. One of the reasons they sell young bulls as soon as they start fighting is because they make a mess and disturb everybody from eating what they need to eat. So they sell most of the bulls, 98% of the bulls, before they reach, in optimal condition, they castrate them, and then they sell when they're about 5 or 6. But they are now, most of them are too poor to do this, so they tend to sell the bulls still as bulls, maybe 2 years old, sometimes even 1 year old. And finally, the Bororo is known to be a very shy animal, incredibly alert. No, you see them, no, like that, no, with the head. They are described as behaving like horses and walking like horses, no, and running like horses. And so in a way, they could be described as very easily stressed animals. And you wonder, no, if these guys are so attentive to the problem of stress, why do they keep animals that seem to be more prone to stress than others? And I think the answer is that they are harnessing stress, just as they are harnessing non-uniform distribution of nutrients on the pasture. And how they do that? They make sure that the animals are very strongly attached to humans. I found references in the literature on animal behavior that particularly during the weaning time, the calf is very much in need, of course, because he's deprived of the contact with the mother. And that is the time when he's more prone to make pals with other, not with peers. Yeah? They use that. They attach all the animals to a rope, all the calves to a rope, in the evening for the night, and they attach them always in the same relative position, from younger to older, and always in the same relative position, so they get accustomed to each other. But above all, during the weaning, the animals, the adults go out in the morning, and the calves stay when the hot is when the sun is hotter. They stay at the camp where they play with children, and the women go around and give them some cereals if there is some. They give them water. They eat this cereal in the same bowl that is used for human food. So all the smells, all the rice smells are there. And they really get socialized into the human family, in a way. And I've seen them, these very aggressive animals, I've seen them coming in the evening to sit close by the fire. In fact, the fire and the relationship with the fire has a very deep symbology in this context, because it has to do with also with the myth of domestication. Why is other groups, particularly sedentary groups and maybe farming groups, tend to describe the origin of domestication in rather dramatic ways? You know, the animal was captured, was attached to the tree, kept without food and water for as long as, you know, his will was broken, and then that was it. It was domesticated, it was tamed. But these people have a completely different story, and they say, they talk about a child who one day spies from behind the bushes, as he was making his fire, spies some very strange animals coming out of a river for some reason, or a lake, or big water, and he's never seen them before, and these are cows. These are the Bororo cows. And the animals are not particularly interested in the child, but they are interested in the fire, because the fire keeps the parasites away, the smoke. So the animals come by the fire, and the child hides behind the bush and looks at them, and is very admires them a lot. So the next day he comes back and makes a fire a little bit further away, and so on and so on. And in the end, now the animals follow the child, and every night, still now, the woman in the household will make a fire for the cows, and they will gather around the fire. And that's the fire of the cows is only for them. And